Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because, after all, money matters. I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and today I have two experts joining me for a very frank and honest discussion about long-term insurance and making sure that you are getting the bang for your buck. Are you overinsured? Because believe it or not, it is possible to have too much insurance. Does your company provide life insurance, and how does that work? Do you understand your premium patterns? Are you going to be able to afford your premiums in 10 years' time? So joining me for this discussion, I have two certified financial planners. So please, I want to welcome Brian Nicol and Johan Piens, who are going to really chat through this with me. And so I really want to say thank you to you two guys for taking the time out of your diaries. And just to kick off, maybe just to give our listeners a bit of background. So this conversation between Brian and Johan and myself started when Brian did a post on LinkedIn, which said, 880,000 Rand wasted on insurance my client didn't need. Now that certainly piqued my interest. And he went on to explain that too many people think of employee benefits, those benefits you have at work, and their personal finances as separate entities. And then Johan posted a comment along with other advisors saying, you know, clients often don't know what cover they have. And Johan is an expert in employee benefits. So I thought, let's get you both on. I follow you both on LinkedIn. I know you don't pull your punches. So I'm looking forward to a really good discussion. And I just want to frame this conversation in two parts, right? So first of all, I want to discuss the employee benefits, how they fit into your financial plan. But as you know, one of my big bugbears are premium patterns and whether or not you can continue to afford your insurance as you age. So I want to make that our second part of the podcast. So guys, who are listening, that's a really important conversation to stay on for as well. But let's start. Brian, your post, what are you seeing when engaging with clients? What is your experience with them?
Thanks, Maya. It's a privilege to be here, firstly. So when I look at the families that we assess, that we work with, that we advise, one of the big things is that a lot of them don't know necessarily what they have. So the employee benefit specifically, if we focus on that, is a bit of a mystery to them. But there seems to be this level of comfort that they have benefits, and so it's going to be okay. You know, like I've got these benefits, I've got a multiple of salary that pays out if I die. So, you know, if my spouse gets 4 million rand, for example, to look after the children, that's more than enough. I mean, we've never had 4 million. They don't understand necessarily that might be nowhere near enough. Because if you take 40,000, 50,000 a month that dependents might need, I mean, Johan would know, you look over that over 20 years, how much income do you have to provide? If you capitalize that, it's going to be a lot of money. And so what we see is, generally speaking, they are aspects of either overinsurance or underinsurance that might occur simply because of maybe the lack of understanding of what the benefits they have, or maybe further than that, the false sense of security that people might get because they joined a company that already has things in place and they feel like they've got it covered. And so that's kind of the main point that seemed to pick up with the families that we work with.
Johan, I mean, that is something you made a comment to me as well, where you say, you know, a client thought they had five times their pensionable salary, but it was actually based on a risk salary, which is 73% of pensionable salary. I find that confusing. I find, what is a pensionable salary? What does that mean? So I think it's really important just to explain when you say your employer has cover that's five times your salary, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, so that goes even deeper, Maya. And again, thank you for the opportunity. Just in terms of, you know, is it approved, is it unapproved benefits? That is a massive implication in terms of tax. So, you know, that how's the tax paid at the end? Is there tax payable in the end? That could also change the amount that you are looking at. And then we have this discussion around pensionable salary versus risk salary and how does the employer see that? Sometimes they give guys multiple options there. It's not just 73%. It might be 100 or 75 and a 60, for example. It depends across the board. But basically, if you have a pensionable salary, I would always tell a client, you know, and members for that fact, to have a discussion with the fund consultant or with their financial advisor to understand what is their pensionable salary amount. And what is the percentage it's based on? So what are you earning? What is the percentage it's actually based on? Or is it maybe a risk salary that they are using, which is 20, 30, maybe 40% lower than your actual salary that you take at the end of the day, which is a tremendous impact, if you can imagine, on that person's demands, you know, at a death payout to the family.
I mean, yeah, it is huge, significantly huge. And I mean, I often just see people saying, oh, I've got five times my salary as, you know, if I pass away, but actually not. I mean, really not. And Johan, you mentioned approved benefits. Just explain, though, the difference between those two, because I know that is also very confusing for many people.
Yes, it is. So in general, we look at two things, approved or unapproved. That is the cover that you can take out, or that's available on a fund. In general, the easiest way to understand it is that in terms of approved benefit, it's actually running through the fund. So it's actually the fund is the conduit of how that money is moving and paid. So what that means is there's no tax liability for the member currently. There's no fringe benefit tax on that. However, when the person then passes away and the benefit pays out to them, that benefit is then taxed in terms of the retirement tax table, lump sum tax table. So that would be the same table you use when you take out your one-third lump sum amount of money, you know, when you're withdrawing from a fund or retiring from a fund. The unapproved benefit is something that you pay a tax to, is usually a fringe benefit tax, while the member is enjoying the benefit or owning that benefit. It isn't provided through the fund. It's a policy owned by the member, and when they then die, that person gets paid this amount of money without any tax implications, and there is no tax for them to pay. So in general, it's a faster payout versus what you have on approved benefits, because approved benefits, again, Section 37C of the Pension Funds Act, trustees have to get involved in how that benefit is distributed. Unapproved death benefit pays out exactly how your benefit nomination, beneficiary form, nomination form, whichever one you use, whoever stated on that, that's how they pay it out. If there is no one stated, pays into the estate, the deceased estate.
I mean, Brian, this is such important stuff. I mean, when you sit with a client, and again, this is where financial planning is absolutely critical. So how do you approach it if you're sitting with a client? Do you ask their employer for the sort of information? And I also want to get your insights, maybe Brian and Johan, on this. Is it more cost effective to go and buy sort of maybe unapproved cover through your employer, or versus taking it out separately? You know, maybe give us some views on that. But Brian, how do you go about saying, okay, client comes to you, they're 35, 40 years old, and they say, oh no, I've got enough life cover. I'm you know, I've got this with my employer. How do you go about understanding this properly?
Yeah, thanks. So what we first got to do with the client is we're always trying to understand, what is this meant for? You know, what is anything meant for? Why are you investing money? What is it meant to do for you and when? And then when it comes to life cover, disability cover, illness and such, we need to understand, what is it meant to do? What problem is it solving? You know, as and when an event, a claimable event, might happen. So an example is, if it's death benefit, if I look at myself, I've got a spouse. Now, there are bills to pay. There's a bond on my house. There are clearly definable things. And then there are lifestyles that have to be maintained if I'm no longer here. My family mustn't suffer. And so what we do is we try and quantify that firstly. So we'll quantify that to work out what you actually need to have in place. And we consider everything in your life with a number on it. So if you, for instance, have rental properties that generate income, if you settle the bonds on those upon passing, then you got a nice cash flow into the family, it might reduce your need for life cover. So we look at firstly what you actually need, what you have available right now, and then we look at the cover that you get through your employer or that you might have in your personal capacity, and see how that helps this. Now, the challenge there sometimes for us is actually getting information on those employee benefits. What we tend to find is that a lot of people might have the incorrect perception of what they've got. A lot of employees might say, I've got this cover and that cover, but they're not really too sure. And so I'll never really take it at face value. So we get granular with everything. So we get statements from the clients. We say, if you belong to certain pension funds, they have portals. Go on there, please, and download. And what they often do is, because because we work virtually, so we're always sharing screens with each other. And so they often go sometimes onto their own portal that they have through their employer fund, download the statements, and we go and say, okay, now go to that one, click on that, download it. Like, we want the actual information. What is very frustrating sometimes, though, I must be honest, is what we see is a lot of the employers don't know what they've got. And so when it comes to HR or someone in that kind of department, they kind of gatekeep a lot of this information, especially for employers whose administrators maybe aren't that sophisticated. They don't have these portals, or they haven't really rolled it out. And so what we actually end up doing is, through the client, we're communicating with their HR and asking questions like, the statement does not say approved or unapproved. And the client might say, you know, I remember they said it's like different to the fund. They'll use words like that. It's like different, because they go to presentation once. Mm-hmm. And so we'll never just go on that. I want to see it in writing. And so we get it in writing from someone. And then if they can't get it, they go to the administrator and they find it and they give us a statement. And sometimes that can take weeks or months. So it's not actually, it doesn't look like this information is made all that available to everyone that is a member of a fund. And it looks like there's a lot of misunderstanding as to what they have. And my concern is that, and I think what I've seen is evidence that people are meeting with their clients as advisors, meeting with their clients. And the client says, I've got this thing, I think it's outside of the fund. They say, okay, so it's unapproved. And they do their planning based on that. And that's extremely dangerous. And so my message is to everyone who's listening is to get the statements. And if people don't know how to get statements, well, then make them learn, because this is very important information. Like the other day, we did this with a client. I say the other day, I think last year sometime. Her statement, I looked at it, and there was a critical illness benefit. Now, this is a listed company. And I said to her, you have critical illness cover in your own personal capacity. You now have many multiples of it, and we don't need that much. We can get rid of this personal one. But I said to her, this statement is from last year. Can you get something newer? Long story short, HR said, no, you've got cover. I said, I want a new member benefit statement. The board removed the critical illness benefit and didn't really tell anyone. And so we would have canceled that for someone in her 50s, and she would not have been able to get insured again. So get the most fresh data, get the statements, get the granular stuff. It's going to serve you as an advisor. It's definitely going to serve the client as well.
Sure. That is just such valuable information. But Johan, where does the consultant come into all of this? Because, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, in all fairness, the employee benefit consultants make a lot of money out of, you know, selling products to these companies. Are they the ones supposed to be informing the employees? Who's actually responsible for informing the employees as to the cover they have?
Maya, I think that's an important question, and I think there's multiple layers involved there. It's never one, you know, isolated layer that you can look at and say, well, guys, fix it, you know, and we'll be better off. I think there's so many layers. I mean, Brian has mentioned from HR to payroll, you know, you asking about the actual fund consultant. So in most cases, yes, I'm very opinionated in the fact that you have service providers, you have an administrator. So you would have a, you know, a Section 13B administrator. You would have a fund consultant. You would have, you know, various other providers out there, platforms, etc., asset managers, risk providers, etc. They must partake in the fund. You must be able to interact with them quite easily, and you must be able to get your information, okay? Lots of times, and this is something that for many years, I mean, I've been doing employee benefits for too many years, actually giving members member benefit statements doesn't help either. It's something that we've tend to see that members themselves even, and I think this is where members need to take some accountability, they actually need to look at that statement. Most of the members, email comes across the desk, put it away, throw it in the dustbin if I get a hard copy. I don't want to see it. Okay, I'm not actually interested. So first off, they need to make an active decision that I want to understand what my benefits look like at work, and then, you know, get that benefit statement. 100% what Brian said, I'm all for educating the member how to get online portal access and educating them through the step of what they can see and what they can't see on their portals. Get that access. It just makes your life easier. You can see literally everything about your pension fund usually on these portals, from rules to understanding categories, what you can take, can't take, risk benefits, you know, medical free cover limits, which is another important topic What pension fund you're contributing at? So what is your contribution rate? How much is actually going into retirement? Where are you invested? How is your investments doing? Everything, absolutely everything. So vitally important. And advisors need to ask members for this. You need to ask every individual client that you see, ask them about that. Ask them, listen, you guys, do you have a member benefit statement? Because it has a holistic impact on any other cover that you might want to take. Just like Brian says, I mean, members have all kinds of different, insurances in their own personal capacity, additional retirement annuities, not just even the risk part of it. So understand what they have already at the employer, because that's something that a member can't get rid of. It's part of their employment contract. So you have to take it. So understand that. Understand the long-term implications of that cover and how it then blends, as Brian mentioned, with your individual needs and wants.
So, Johan, I just wanted to pick up something on something Brian said about that critical illness cover. So he was saying, if you've got critical illness with your company, you may be duplicated. But what about the continuation option? And this is very important because if you leave your company, what happens? If you retire from your company, so I mean, critical illness for me would be the one that you would take into retirement, right? Because you're most likely going to need it. Just explain to our listeners, the options if you are on your employer's, risk benefits, are you able to take them over as an individual if you leave for whether it's resignation or retirement?
Yeah, so happy to have a discussion on that. My first up, I just want to mention, and this is something we come across a lot, is guys with income disability benefits, both inside and outside of the fund. So while you're actively working, you can't have two types of disabilities. You can't have one inside the fund and outside the fund covering you for 75%. I mean, that's 150%. No insurer is going to pay that. So something very important to understand, and that's why we say, get the picture, because if you don't need that cover, you don't need it, or maybe you just need to fill a bit of that cover. Okay. So in terms of the what you can take and conversion options, etc. So in most cases, there's continuation options or conversion options. So there is interchangeable names to it as well, and we use it differently in the industry, but those two allow a member then to actually convert the cover into their own personal capacity. Okay. And usually it's a benefit they pay for. Not usually, it is a benefit that they pay for. It's usually a minute part, but again, there is that benefit usually available in the employee benefit space if it is included in the package. And that means that the member can then, when they resign from an employer and decide that they want to actually transfer the group benefit into their own personal capacity, they can then do that. And usually there's a few benefits that come with it. And some of these benefits include things like, you don't have to go and do medicals, for example. They might just ask you for a smoker's test, so to see if you smoke, and then usually an HIV test. So they won't do any other medicals as long as you are, within the free medical free cover limit, not over it. But then usually the member can take it in their own name. Most of the time, your income disability stops at 65. All income disability stops at age 65. Can't take it longer than that. Some employers do allow for the member to take that into retirement. So when they retire, they can convert the benefit. I would always say to a member, again, ask for the benefit statement so you can see when they can convert up to, because sometimes they limit it. 5 years prior to retirement, you have to take it. If you haven't taken it prior to that, then there might be some issues there. So it's vitally important for the guys to understand that.
Yeah, I would love to just maybe give like maybe Brian, you want to start with that 5 questions you should go right now and ask your employer. Brian, you start and Johan, you'll add on anything that Brian's missed out.
Well, I think the first thing is, what do I have? And whatever you just told me now, I don't understand it. So please re-explain it in a way that I understand it. And that is important. A lot of people, like I've had clients come to me, they'll say, I've got approved, which means it's the good one, right? Or something like that. They don't understand what this means, but these are basic concepts for a fund administrator to maybe, by fund administrator, I mean the guys running the retirement fund. For them to even have a really simple pre-recorded video where they just, it's available to everybody, or they can just, I've never seen that before, where they explain it in simple layman's English, to say, this is what you got. You die, this pays, whatever the case may be. So firstly, what have I got? Then secondly, how, if it's a retirement fund, how is my money invested? Thirdly, to clarify if the risk benefits that you're getting are inside or outside of the fund, as Johan mentioned earlier on. You don't think it's possible to actually just explain how big of a deal that is. When we do risk planning for clients, if it's inside or outside of the fund, it's a massive difference. And so to understand the nature of that, and then fourthly, I would say, if I die, explain to me the process of where my money goes and when. Because what we tend to find with a lot of retirement funds is a lot of the members don't have updated beneficiary forms. So if they pass away, it's going to pay to their estate, maybe. Meantime, it's meant to pay to a spouse, because since they started the job, they got married and have children. Now the money is wound up in a deceased estate. And these days in South Africa, that takes years to wrap up. And so if it's, they just had to put one person's name on the on that line. If it is an approved fund, which means that the risk benefits are within the retirement fund, the money might not be paid out for a while, and it might be worthwhile then that member of that fund getting out a little bit of life cover outside of the fund that will pay out to a spouse in case of death, which will bridge, it'll be bridging finance basically. These are the kinds of questions I would ask, but I know Jan's got probably a few more to add, but what I just want to say though, that it's called personal finance for a reason. It's your personal responsibility to know this. We can blame advisors as much as we want to. We can blame employers. We can blame benefit consultants. But at the end of the day, it's literally going to be the consumer carrying the can. And it's I think it depends on how much time and effort you put into understanding this is will be related to what you get out of it at the end of the day.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's part of all the financial education you guys do, or we do, I do, is to try and get people to ask the right questions. And that's why it's always great to give them the questions. And of course, I would just add, find out whether you have a continuation option or not. Like, can I keep this cover when I leave? Because obviously that matters as well. Because if you can't keep it and you're now having to underwrite at the age of 50, that could be significant. Johan, what else do you want to add?
So I've just got three that I think I'd add. So when there's an income disability benefit available on your fund, always ask the question whether there's continuation option and a retirement waiver. You just want to ensure that if there is death benefit cover, so continuation of cover during disability just means that they keep your death benefit available. So they continue paying for it even though you are disabled, but that ensures that if you do then pass away from your disability, there is coverage and there is payment to your family, in terms of a death benefit that's still available to them. And then lastly was the retirement waiver, just to ensure that the contribution continues towards the retirement benefit. And we always say to the guys, there's three things that happen when you get disabled. You either recover from the disability, which is great, you're going to start working again, hopefully, or you might pass away from that disability, therefore you need the death benefit cover. And number three is if I, what was the third one now that we mentioned?
You retire early, probably.
Yes, correctly. So you have retirement funding, not retire early, I hope. But if there is, and you get to retirement 65 and that policy then stops, there is retirement monies for you to continue with. And you're not now suddenly, out of pocket because you don't have any money. The other two things that I would mention just quickly is understand the last stage option available on the fund. Most funds make a last stage investment option available. Understand that investment portfolio and how it works. When do you get de-risked? When don't you? So when are they moving you into more conservative portfolios? We're seeing a big thing happening in that space in terms of members not having enough money when they get retirement, yet we are de-risking them. Does it make sense? But again, it's something that you need to take up with a financial advisor. It's your personal situation, because what you're aiming for at retirement might be super, super different. And lastly, beneficiary forms. Any changes, beneficiary forms, life-changing, change them. Go to your employer, say to them, guys, we need to change it. You never want that money to fall in a deceased estate when you could have easily, very easily just written down the name, you know, and allocated money to it.
Absolutely. I hope, I really would love, maybe we can do like a real push fit over the, that we make April the month, April and May the months that you go and you ask the right questions about your employee benefits and actually find out about them. Really, really important. And it's quite interesting. Sometimes I see employee benefit statements and some companies are very, especially if you happen to work for an insurer, by the way, you have really rich cover and you're paying for it, by the way. It does come off your cost to company. So it's really worth understanding. But I think that's, you know, we kind of looked now at the employee benefit side, making sure that you are not underinsured, that you think you have insurance that is sufficient and it's not, but that you're also not overinsured. I mean, I think Johan, the point you made that you can't have disability, you can't claim disability cover twice, or income protection twice. So there's no point in having both at the same time. So I think that that's a really, really important one as well. But now I want to move to part two of this discussion, which is, you know, moving away from employee benefits, which are provided by your employer, and looking at your own cover. So you've gone out and you've bought life insurance, you've bought, like I do, because I don't have an employer, critical illness, disability, all of those things. I am getting so many complaints from people around the ages of about 55 who can no longer afford their premiums. And when I have a look at it, a lot of it is the premium pattern. It's the way that this product was sold. And I think it's extremely important that we have this conversation. We need to be honest about this conversation. And I think I also really want to look at, you know, discounts based on behavior or health statistics, because when you can't meet those criteria any longer, the cover becomes unaffordable. And I think we're starting to see, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost, or, you know, from what was perhaps sold 10 to 15 years ago. Maybe it's a little contentious statement, but who wants to kick off there first? Brian?
Okay. I deal with this all the time. I deal with this all the time with clients that we, you know, we have a new business. It's just over 2 years old. So all my clients, or most of my clients, are relatively new. And so we've been doing the initial planning with over 50 families now, for since the beginning of this business. And it's very eye-opening to see. I mean, the other day, 2 weeks ago, I got a mail from a client at Office 9, I think in the evening. She runs her own business. She's in her late 50s. And she said she can no longer keep her life cover. It's more about the dread disease or the critical illness. That's the main thing. It's very important to have that cover. Well, you're in the red zone now in terms of age, your lifestyle diseases, the cancers and all of that, unfortunately, come about. And critical illness, I think, is the highest claimed cover in South Africa. Last thing I read, statistic I read from a CISA. So it's a highly claimed cover. It is highly expensive, though, because there are so many claims these days for lifestyle diseases, especially, and cancer. And now what was happening with this particular client, but she can serve as a proxy for them all, is that it was super cheap when she was sold to her 10, 15 years ago. But the annual escalations in the premiums, I think for her, was like 19% a year. Now what's going to happen is that's going to snowball like no investment can, really. And it's just going to get so expensive so quickly. Unfortunately, there are some insurers, I don't even think they have any other option, really. They don't really have a level option. That's why we don't deal with them at all. And what that tells me is two things. And this is maybe where Jan can add, agree or disagree, but when a policy is sold with such an aggressive premium pattern, so if it goes up by double figures every year, then initially the premium is going to be cheaper. So what you might be doing in that situation is either the person comes to you and they say, I really need this cover, I don't have much money available. And the advisor might say, the wrong question is, how much do you have available? It's not the right question to ask. And so what they will say is, I've got 400 rand a month. Okay, I can get you R1 million cover in your 30s for 400 rand a month. Haha, 15 years later, it's going to cost you about R6 grand a month. But that's not my problem. And so they make the sale now, and then it becomes affordable. It's affordable now, but it's not affordable later. So that could be due to client affordability problems at the outset. Although if you show them a projection of those premiums over time, I think that argument will become moot by year like 7 or 8. The other thing is, I need to make a sale. And so it's a very competitive environment. I'm sure you've been on the phone before with short-term insurers and you're playing the one against the other. This one's giving me this one's giving me that. And everyone tries to undercut. And normally what they have to play with is a premium pattern. And so it happens the same with advisors. And so that's probably a symptom of a misalignment of incentives in our industry. But at the end of the day, those are two primary reasons that you might have that scenario. And the one who loses out, once again, is the consumer.
And I just want to take a step back just to explain to the listeners what these different premiums are. So you've got what you'd call the level premium. So level premium is I've got 1 million rand with a life cover. I keep it at 1 million rand, and I'm not going. It's kind of leveled out over my lifetime. So I may pay a little bit more now in order not to pay so much later. So it's kind of leveled out. Then you have level premium with cover increase. So you're saying, well, every year I want my cover to increase by 10%. So that may go from 1 million to 100,000, 1.1 million, et cetera, every year. That has slightly more aggressive pattern because you're increasing your cover. And often when it depends again on how the insurer does it, but they may consider that new cover at your new age. So now you're 50 and that every time your cover increases, they increase it at your age risk. And then the most aggressive one would be age rated. So you will pay according to your age. At 30, you're going to pay a lot less than when you're 55. Now, if you have age rated with cover increase, you could be looking at 30% increases, for example. So and would that be a good way, Johan, I don't know, of explaining the different patterns?
So I myself have some clients across both all three, let's call it that, spectrum or categories, if we want to say that. And again, I think what I would agree with Brian is I think it's the misalignment on how people are remunerated, etc. Because it's more again, once again, about the sale versus potentially what is needed at the time. And most of my clients, where we do, for example, have an age rated in place, they are explained the difference, upfront to say this is what it is, this is what it looks like compared to a level premium. So they have that understanding. And then I was shocked now to hear the 19% increase, which is extremely high. But I mean, in most cases, I say to the client, next year, I'm going to come and see you. When I see you, we review, is there a need to increase or, do we keep it the same? And if we need to keep it the same, I just bring it back, if there is an increase. And that's what we are there to do as the person that helps them and say, well, every year, let's sit down. Is anything changed? Is there a difference? Is there, something that's happening up coming up? Is there something that happened, or can we keep things the same, and carry on as is? So I think it's important to have that discussion with the clients up front so they understand the difference between them. And then based on that, make a well put together discussion. After a well put together discussion, you then make a decision on which way to go forward. And they are aware of why they're taking that cover and what the implication is going forward. So that in 15 years, they don't have to phone you and say, listen, yeah, sorry, can't afford this anymore.
I was chatting to another financial advisor who said to me, there is a place for age rated, especially on life cover, because he said you've got somebody between the ages of maybe 35 to 45, 50, you have your biggest need for life cover. You've got bonds, you've got children, you know that if something happens to you, you need to educate them. But you also have the highest cost pressure. So age rated can work really well then, knowing that you're probably going to cancel it at age 50. So if you understand that, of course you can then, I think it's BrightRock who does an actual, I mean, you can buy a term policy as well, where you say, I'm only going to keep it for this term, which by the way saves you a fortune. So I think that's it, right? What do I need this cover for? I can't afford to take the level premium at this point, but I only need the cover for the next 10 years. After that, hopefully, my debts are less, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is where we're losing without good financial advice, without somebody explaining that this is where people are just buying policies. They never hear from the advisor again. And then they come to a point where they just can't afford it anymore. So I think that is, for me, Johan, the absolute critical thing is that if you are selling someone a policy, it is your duty to make sure that you stay with that person and you make sure that that cover remains relevant for their needs. Absolutely.
100%. I can't agree with you more. And for that matter of fact, it's the same on the fund, on your employee benefits. Understand why the cover is there. Understand what you're going to use it for in the future. and understand if there's a difference between that and what I actually need. You know, and lots of the time, the people don't have that understanding. You don't have the financial advisor sitting next to them explaining all these concepts and things to them, and they just accept blanket, you know, whatever is said to them.
Yeah. But Maya, on that, just a bit of advice for the consumer. A few things that they can do, you know, if you're out there now looking for life cover and you're speaking to an advisor, and maybe the advisor got you, if they're independent, they got you probably three quotes from different providers. All providers provide quotes that, and when I say providers, I mean insurers. All the insurers give you quotes that at the different premium patterns. And so you can ask and say, look, yeah, this is long-term cover. Maybe it's income protection, which is actually a very expensive one. And you can say, show me the different premium patterns. Then you can compare and you can see at which point, where the inflection point is, where at which point the one becomes long-term more cost-effective. The second thing you can do, which we've done before, is you take the premiums, you come up with an Excel calculator, and you just put it in 12, times 12, and then what the projected increase will be times 12, times 12, and you just do a table. And you can look at total contributions to the policy over however many years. And you'll get a feel for what costs more. So it's the delaying the gratification. So the if you say I'll pay more now so I can pay less over time, that is the kind of conversation you can have with an advisor. At least one, I think, that's got your back. And then what you can do is help make a long-term informed decision, a financial decision, because everything we do is a long-term financial decision. It just seems like in the now, I've got 500 rand available and use that on a premium. Well, do you know what the cost will be? Because it's going to be very difficult to change this in the future. So look at the different options. Do the calculations. Ask the advisor if they're amenable to it to do the calculations for you, and then make a rather a much more informed financial decision. And don't just trust what the person tells you. Don't just say like, if the person says this is the best one to go for, that means nothing. Best for who? And that's generally the question I would want the consumer to ask of the advisor.
Very, I mean, that's really, really important. And I, you know, I was thinking a little bit earlier about critical illness. You know, so much of the other cover we can let go, right? Your life cover, you need less as you get older. Disability cover falls away anyway when you're 65. Critical illness is critical when you get older. You are more likely to claim for that over the age of 60. So how do you go about, you know, deciding you don't want to get an, you know, one that's too aggressive and you're aggressive on premiums, but it is an incredibly expensive cover. How do you go around finding the affordability aspect of age rate when it comes to critical illness? Would you just say, well, even a little bit of critical illness cover is better than none? Brian, how do you make that decision? Because I find critical illness is just, it really eats a lot out of my budget.
It is a very necessary benefit that you need. I've seen it change people's lives. You know, when you're fighting an illness, and just to give the listeners, I don't know what the understanding of critical illness is, but if you are diagnosed with one of the many illnesses that are generally covered by these policies, the big ones are cancer, stages 1 through 4, heart disease, strokes. Then what happens is, upon a successful claim, it'll pay out a tax-free amount into your bank account. And so, if you have a critical illness cover of 1 million rand, and now you got diagnosed with terrible, like say, cancer, your focus is going to be on what? It's going to be fighting the illness. And so, the last thing you want to worry about is the thing that causes the most illness, probably is stress over money. And so, now you've got this benefit that'll pay out and it'll help you fight this. And it will also help you adapt your lifestyle to whatever illness you are fighting. Now, if we can go back to the question, how do you quantify this, and how much do you need? You know, it's kind of, unfortunately, it's one of those how long is a piece of string questions. What we look at is that for a particular person, we look at what they need to have done, what they need to have taken care of in their estate, should they be incapacitated or fighting an illness. So we'd look at firstly what immediate obligations they have towards lenders. So if they are, because a critical illness claim might pay out, and you might not be in the territory of a disability claim yet, but you might, like I work for myself. If I'm diagnosed, touch wood, with something terrible, I might take time off work and I might not earn. So I might get income protection, but I don't want the bank breathing down my neck. So there might be certain debts you might want to just get rid of and clear your plate so you don't have to worry about that. Then you would say, fine, 500,000 rand left on my house. That's the only debt I've got. I would like to have a bit available in case I need to take time out. I need to go to a clinic or a retreat or something like that. So you can boost that up by a certain amount more. And so what's a nice starting point, like a rule of thumb, as much as I don't necessarily like them, is in the employee benefit space, ironically, one times annual salary. They generally start with that. And I think that's a nice starting point to just commence the conversation about this cover. You can get a quotation on that. So if you're earning 500,000 a year, get a quotation for critical illness cover that for 500,000 and see what the cost is. My advice there, though, is get the most comprehensive cover you can possibly afford. And I'm not talking about bells and whistles where it integrates with this thing and if you go to gym or whatever. I'm not talking about rubbish. What I'm talking about is you will get paid out for stage one cancer as well as stage four and not have to, prove the world to the claims department to try and get the money out. So it normally costs a couple of bucks more per month, maybe 100, 200, depending on the amount of cover. Try and go for gold there because it's the worst cover to have to claim for, but at the same time, it could be the most available cover you've ever claimed for. And then secondly, I would strive to get it on a level premium if possible. A level premium where even if you're older now, say you are maybe late 40s or 50s and you want to get this cover out, you could even get it and not let it grow potentially. So you can get level. So it's level. So the premium pattern is level and never go up. The cover is level, it will never go up. Or you can do it in a situation where the premium, the cover goes up with the cost of living every year, so inflation, and then your premium pattern will go up incrementally. And then in later in life, as you no longer have those debts, as your life circumstances change, as your children are out of the house and you no longer need spare cash around to help pay for your kid's first car that you always wanted to do or anything like that, you can then start trimming it and then proportionately reduce your premium and keep what you think you might need later in life. If you go for the more aggressive premium now, in other words, if you go for the cheaper premium now, you're going to come back to this podcast and listen to it again because in the beginning, we mentioned the problems with that.
And I think, one of the other ways I'm looking at my critical illness is thinking, well, my children are nearly at an age where I don't have to support them anymore, which means my life cover is going to fall away because I took our term, I structured mine on term basis. So, or it reduces dramatically. So the money that I was spending on my life cover, I can now at least use to make sure that I can keep my critical illness in place. So I think we also change the type of cover we need. And I think those, again, Johan, as well, like this is so important to keep reviewing because these are all the moving parts. You're saying, okay, you're going to get to when you get to 65, your debts are paid off. You don't really need that much life cover, but you really need to keep your critical illness in place. It's difficult always to increase your critical illness because you may already have some kind of, conditions already. But, these are some of the things to do is to say, this is, you can almost have like an amount that you spend on insurance every month, but then alter the cover based on where you are in your life.
100%, Maya. And I mean, that's whether it's individual or even under employee benefits, you now mentioned a couple of these stories. We seem to see a similar thing in the employee benefit space where we say to the guys, but when someone joins your business and they are 24, to around 30, do they really need five times or eight times, death benefit cover? Is that really necessary? Or maybe can we trim it down to like a one or a two times for those guys, and this is all a possibility in the fund space. They can categorize and make different categories. It becomes a bit of an admin issue, but it's easy to do and put those type of changes in place because people change, the circumstances change, your lifestyle changes, your things change, you have kids, you get married, you get divorced, people pass away. So again, when they're younger, we tend to see the guys in the EB space, employee benefit space. There's not a big need for, death benefit, more a need for income disability, obviously. Then we get to this period in between where they start, having kids, getting married, that type of, story up until about age 50 to 55 in the employee benefit space. And then they, looking for a five to an eight times death benefit because that is what I need. If something happens to my family, my wife is sorted, my kids are sorted, everyone's happy. And then again, that starts changing when they get to, age 55? Do I really need all that cover? And all along this step, and what I say to the guys, and this is why you need to understand your benefits at work and how it fits into your total financial plan. If you can save a couple of cents or rands at that beginning stage in the death benefit, you know, reducing it from a 5 to a 2 times, let's say you get 100 rand back, that's 100 rand that actually goes towards your retirement, which is, you know, the more important part of a retirement or a pension fund when we look at it. That should be the first objective, to get my member, you know, to retire comfortably. So there we can already see. Then as the lifestyle changes, we can make something happen. And then again, towards the end, there's a possibility. And, you know, nowadays, Sanlam came out with the story of the research to say people actually retire at age 80, not age 65. They only have about 25% of their need at age 65. So if we take 55 to 80, there's quite some time there still where a member could, rather than be paying for a high, you know, premium on insurance, they could be paying for something that suits them and fits the need that they've got. And the rest of the money could be, you know, put somewhere else where they can actually invest it for retirement or discretionary or tax-free or whatever other vehicle is available. So I understand it. It just makes it easier. And if you're an employer, if you're an employer, Maya, consider, you know, different categories.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a need for it we see out there in the industry.
I think it's such an interesting concept as well, because, of course, for most people, it's a deduction of as a percentage of salary. So you'll say I'm deducting 15%, but not 15% is not going to retirement, right? 2 or 3% is going to risk benefits. So you're saying, well, this young person doesn't quite need the same amount of life cover, so we should be giving them a little bit more on the retirement coverage. So I think that is, I mean, that is really, really important. I want to maybe end off with a slightly, perhaps we're going to get a little bit contentious here, but I'm a bit concerned about advisors who sell policies based on your current health. And we know there's one very large insurer who does a lot of this, but many of them do it where, you know, you can get this huge discount and then you're comparing, you're saying, oh, well, this is cheaper than other cover, but it shouldn't really be. For me, I really feel that if you are going to be taking out insurance, you should be comparing like with like. And then if your health benefits or the way you exercise or your lifestyle adds additional discounts, that's fantastic. But if you are buying it up front because it's cheaper with the hope that you will stay fit and healthy, I'm seeing a lot of problems here. I really am. When people are unable to maintain their, you know, the requirements to keep those discounts, those products are becoming very expensive. And usually at an age around 50, where to now change life cover or change insurer becomes more challenging. Brian, do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So I know who you're talking about. We don't work with them for that reason. I think you're not in the business of insuring people's health when you make sure that it's unaffordable in the moment when they really need it most. So if you have critical illness cover and it becomes so unaffordable in your 50s because of these stupid bells and whistles that the people selling it can't understand, then you don't really care about that consumer. What you care about potentially is how sexy the product looks, how it integrates with everything, and how what a good story it tells. But we know, I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but I can tell you now, people's lifestyle change over the 40s, 50s, 60s. They throw their back out. They can no longer do the comrades every year. And things change. They work in a job and they're stressed and they get hypertension and so on. And now all of a sudden, they're being penalized in their policies. And now the policy is like a lot more expensive than it used to be. So I don't think it's a contentious issue. I think it's a very logical and ethical issue. And if you design products that seem to penalize people for aging when the product is supposed to be affordable when they age, then it doesn't lead me to believe that you really want them to maybe have the cover at that stage, or you want to trap them. And either way, I don't think that is acceptable. And so we don't sell any bells and whistles. Like, we don't work with any companies that do that. And the simple reason is because you pay for them. And secondly, no one understands how they work. And if someone cannot explain how it works, they have no right to pass it on to a consumer.
Johanna, you got any comments on that?
Mm-hmm. So I echo Brian's sentiments. I'm also pretty vocal about these other fees and that we can magically make disappear. And for me, the fact is that, you know, you sell them the cover for a reason. We, you know, that is why the cover's in place. There shouldn't be any hurdles along the way for them to cross to actually get that cover when they need it most, as Brian said. You know, bells and whistles, not interested, guys. Please make sure that the insurance that you're taking is for the insurance reason. Understand that requirement. Understand what you want it for. Get it for that reason, for no other reason. Whether it integrates, whether it makes it sexier. You know, I think the more boring it is, the better. That's usually my view on it. On the side of caution, you know, if it looks too good, it is too good. You know, those are the simple rule of thumbs that we use. And I say again to the consumer and the person out there looking for the financial or the insurance cover, speak to your financial advisor, speak to a financial advisor, you know, get in touch. You know, I'm sure Brian doesn't mind, JP doesn't mind, but speak to someone, just ask the question. If you don't ask the question, you won't know, you know, and potentially down the line, you have problems with that product exactly like now because you missed the bonus. And I just can't see the fact that imagine someone at 55 now had a heart attack and it was not due to anything that this person did. They could have been super fit. They could have been the healthiest person. We read about this all the time, guys. And then they suddenly, you know, pass away. Sorry, we're not paying the claim because, or we're paying half the money out or quarter of the money out because you didn't stay at this level of whatever bonus loyalty program you've got. No, can't be.
You know, I was given a, you know, I do get financial advisors sending me some of these statements because they're just horrified. And there is one chap who's, he will, at 65, he will get a large bonus payout, but he has to maintain a premium of like 20,000 rand a month for, I can't remember the cover. The cover was ridiculously, I mean, it was certainly not, you know, it didn't correlate with the premium. So it's there to try and keep you paying to, and now you've got this bonus hanging over there. And now you're trying to work out how are you going to fund these premiums so that you can get that bonus? I'm sorry. This is not insurance anymore. This is something else. This is gamification or, and I agree. I have some serious, serious concerns about product development around this. And I'm just to give you a non-life insurance thing, example. My mom had a car accident. Somebody went into the back of her, wrote her car off. We contact her insurer, short-term insurer, and they say, well, why don't you go and claim directly from the person because then you won't lose your no claims bonus. And I said, no, she has insurance to claim. That is why, because she's 85, she doesn't now want to go through loops and hoops to go and find some other way so that you don't have to pay her out. And I'm getting a little bit frustrated with this kind of like, you know, take out insurance, but please don't ever claim. That's not, I don't think that's the best insurance.
It's not, but I think people, and it clearly works. The business model clearly works because people are signing up for these, but yeah, I need the, you know, you hit the nail on the head earlier on. When it comes to insurance and when it comes to investing, it needs to be as plain and boring as possible. If I have life cover and if I die, the life cover must pay out. I don't care about anything else. And so why would anything else be even remotely important in this conversation? It just simply isn't. But now it might pay out a little bit more if I do this thing and dance on my head or whatever the case may be. Well, I don't care. I'll be dead. And I've got the amount of cover I need for my family. That's all I want. But now you're making me pay extra for something else that might or might not happen. So to my mind, it's not in the best interest of the client. And when these things come about, I start questioning the validity of clauses in our legislation like TCF, treating customers fairly and that, where you're not supposed to have any sort of barriers to doing business. You're not supposed to have any barriers to claiming. You're not supposed to have any barriers to cancellations, which is a massive problem with some of these insurers. It just seems to me it's a free for all. And so instead of our business, when we invest with clients, it's as low cost and as vanilla as possible. The insurers, if they need life cover to pay out, we go to the one that offers it at the best cost because at the end of the day, they pay out if there's no pulse. That's literally it. And so there doesn't have to be anything special. Rewards programs scare the absolute hell out of me. And I think they should scare the hell out of everyone because they will move those goalposts every year. And everything that you had planned, all those alignments of goals and visions and bonuses and payouts, they will just change something and it throws it all into the air. So you can't plan on that. Then that's just hope. And hope isn't a plan.
Love it. Definitely going to pull that out as a quote, Brian. Fantastic. Any last words from you, Johan?
No, I just echo exactly what he said. It should be plain. It should be boring. It should be really vanilla. Look for price. When you get to insurance is about exactly what you said. If you die, if you get disabled, if you get a critical illness, I need to at that stage get hold of that, and let's make sure that we get the guys to there. I don't want to add on all kinds of this and that. And maybe if you do that, you're going to get this. And, but when they do eventually get there and something happens, then suddenly, okay, but we can't do this anymore because now the person. So, Echo, thank you, Brian. I fully agree with you.
Okay, so the summary of this entire podcast is insurance should be boring.
That's right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you both of you for joining and unpacking this for us today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Pleasure. Thanks.